Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I admire greatly and whose clarity about the war for the free world I particularly admire is our first guest. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is a senior contributor at The Federalist, a terrific online resource. He is a fellow at the Claremont Institute. He is also the author of American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party, as well as a columnist for Newsweek. Ben, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back. It's good to be able to talk with you in particular about something you wrote about in Newsweek last month. It involves an agency that I think most of us have never heard of, at least in its current incarnation, the U.S. Agency for Global Media. It has recently, at long last, had an old friend of mine, Michael Pack, established as its director or CEO or whatever role he's currently playing. His mission there has been to try to really see if he can't finally bring the resources and skills of that agency that, among other things, you know, has the role of managing the Voice of America and other entities like Radio Free Europe and Radio Free Asia to bear on behalf of our country, which has for altogether too long not been their job. Talk a little bit about what's going on there and Michael's role.
It's really remarkable how these U.S. government media entities have actually worked at cross purposes to the Voice of America, have actually stifled the Voice of America, and far too often, as the White House itself has said, served as the voice of our worst adversaries in many cases. So yes, this is a major battle that's going on sort of behind the scenes, but really should be of interest to every American because USAGM is an essential asset in the war of ideas across the world, in promoting the U.S. government's message, in this case, the proper message about values such as liberty and justice, and also about exposing the atrocities of some of our worst adversaries. And of course, those worst adversaries want to stifle the free flow of information and ideas because information and ideas and truth are toxic to those regimes. So Michael Pack, it should be noted, went through a multi-year fight just to get this nomination, only was able to be confirmed in the final year of the first term of the Trump presidency. And the reason the fight was so great was because those who had been in power, namely Obama appointees at the top levels of these various entities that comprise USAGM, including the person at the top, were all working in a sense against America's national interest, in my view, and in the view, again, of the Trump White House. And so what Michael Pack has been brought in to do and why he was fought so viciously by many on the left and unfortunately some with R's next in their name as well is because he was brought in to actually make the USAGM stand for American national interest, put forth the administration's view of America and of our adversaries, which it is statutorily charged to do and which it had not been doing. And two of the greatest focuses of Michael Pack have been, one, trying to take the war to China in terms of the war of ideas, not in a bellicose way, but in terms of just putting forth truth about the nature, the hostile nature, the totalitarian nature of the Chinese Communist Party, and then also dealing with the massive security breaches that have happened at USAGM, which I wrote about in this recent Newsweek column, in which Michael Pack has now exposed the fact that there were massive, massive security breaches within USAGM, namely involving the lack of vetting of any number of foreign employees of USAGM, which creates a massive national security risk. And in particular, there's reporting that indicates that it involved its Chinese employees, as well as potentially Iranian and Russian ones as well. So that's a massive security breach. These are two massive efforts of Michael Pack.
to put a fine point on it, Ben Weingarten, we're talking about an agency whose need at a moment when we must be communicating the truth to foreign audiences as assiduously as we can. This agency has been undermined from within by Obama holdovers on the one hand and foreign employees, some of whom there may well be security concerns about. And the net result was, at least for the 3 years of this presidency, prior to Michael Peck coming to office, and the previous administration, needless to say, was an output that was not the truth. It was, in some cases, at least a mix of American truth-telling and foreign government propaganda, including that of Chinese communists. It's just unbelievable that this would come to it, but thank heavens Michael Peck is there now, trying to clean out, the Greeks would have called it the Aegean stables, no?
These were essential tools in our Cold War arsenal, and they're being made useful tools again. And the tragedy of this is that it took till the fourth year of the first term of the Trump presidency to get there, but it's an essential fight in the war of ideas that's taking place right now. And that's why the administration really needs outside support in this, because it's such an essential tool that's been overlooked for too long by too many.
Let me turn quickly to the subject of your book, American Ingrate, about Ilhan Omar and the progressive Islamist takeover of the Democratic Party. We certainly see that in the sort of revolution that's been going on in our streets of late, with the strong and enthusiastic and very vocal support of Ilhan Omar. Tell us about how you see things in light of what's now not just a takeover of a party, but of some of America's most important cities by these revolutionaries.
Yeah, the thesis of my book is that Ilhan Omar was the future, if not the present, of the Democrat Party. And as I detail chapter and verse in American Ingrates, she stands for an anti-American, revolutionary, leftist, hard left ideology rooted in intersectional theory and identity politics. And what we've seen is the total embrace, if not caving to, that sort of philosophy that manifests itself in the rioting, destruction, literal fires in American streets across the country today, most notably, of course, in Congresswoman Omar's district, which encompasses Minneapolis, among other places. So I think what we're seeing is that the book's thesis is being proven in real time, which is that the Democratic Party has caved to these elements, these progressive elements, and they signaled that they were going to do so when they caved to Congresswoman Omar in any number of instances, as I document in the book. So when she calls for dismantling systems of oppression, what she's talking about is the American system. And it's been very clear in her rhetoric and the policies that she supports for several years now. And it's just become mainstream in her party. The party has shifted the Overton window such that someone like Congresswoman Omar could be acceptable. And now, even worse than that, at the top of the ticket, we see an unwillingness to condemn, which is essentially a green light for this tyranny in our streets to continue, because they recognize that's where the energy in their party base is. And that's a tragedy for the country. And Rep. Omar is a symbol for what the Democratic Party is and will be going forward if we don't reject it as a people.
Ben Weingarten, thank you very much for your time today, as well as the important work you're doing at the Claremont Institute, the Federalist, and of course, Newsweek. I hope you come back to us again very soon and stay on the case, particularly of Ilhan Omar, if you would. Next up, Dinah West will join us. We'll talk with her about the culture wars and the anti-Trump conspiracy and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and one of the high points of our week is at hand. It is our visit with Dinah West, a longtime observer, monitor, rapporteur, analyst of our culture and our country's influence under the culture, particularly now dominated by the radical left. She is the author of three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and The Red Thread. She blogs at dinahwest.net, and she graces us each week right about now. Dinah West, it's so good to talk with you. Welcome back. I wondered what you made, Dinah, of the attacks on President Trump precipitated initially by Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, that became clearly the centerpiece of a carefully orchestrated effort by not only him, of course, and others in the media, but the Democratic Party, the Biden campaign, and evidently some deep state types inside the Trump administration, though we're not entirely clear who they are because they've only been identified as anonymous. What's up with this? And does this seem to be further manifestation of what you've described as the anti-Trump conspiracy?
Well, in answer to that last bit, yes, of course. It's not just a conspiracy against President Trump, however. It's a conspiracy against the American people. It's a conspiracy against journalism. It's a conspiracy against the democratic process. I mean, these are desperate times, and these are desperate measures. And we see in the Jeffrey Goldberg debacle this effort, first of all, to suddenly break as news a story that was debunked 2 years ago. I mean, this is the story about President Trump and making all of these horrible comments, allegedly, that no one can confirm, 2 years ago, that were essentially debunked with a raft of FOIA documents at the time, in terms of a travel that was canceled due to inclement weather in France. I mean, this is sort of the basis of that entire story. Now it gets broken again as news, which is bizarre, and it becomes so clearly used as a sledgehammer to drive a wedge between President Trump and his very strongly pro-military base, military ballots. I mean, this is such a hit on the election process. It is not bringing light. It is bringing heat. And you know, it required a number of efforts to people standing up who are actually in these conversations saying, no, this is not true, versus anonymous sources. And frankly, the whole thing becomes, I think, an exercise and a discussion that's within a very tiny circle of people. I don't think this is the kind of thing that actually has legs outside of the sort of swampy regions. But it's another iteration of this effort to tear this man down by tearing down his personality and what he stands for. And you know, it's ugly to go through and difficult, but I don't think this is the end of it, and I don't think it's successful, but it's part of this endlessly battering ram against him that we've been watching for 5 years now.
The thing that I'm particularly interested in, though, Diana, I was on Alex Marlowe's show on Breitbart this morning, and he pointed out the immediate effort that was made by the Biden campaign and by other, you know, surrogates and Democratic Party apparatchiks, as well as others in the media, of course, but also seemingly people in the military to some extent, though again unnamed, to pile on to this attack on Donald Trump. This clearly politically timed, as well as politically charged, attack on President Trump. Does that surprise you, given what we've seen of this conspiracy to date? Or is this just more of the same? Or is it being ratcheted up for political warfare purposes?
Sure. I mean, it's a well-oiled machine at this point. And no, it doesn't surprise me. It's exactly how it works. Someone throws a handful of mud at the wall, and then everyone else tries to make it stick from their various vantage points. I mean, it's almost like a gang that becomes involved in this kind of a disinformation effort. It's an echo chamber, and that is how it is designed to work. And what is so disturbing is when you see people coming out of positions of authority, either in democratic politics or the military, other places in supposedly journalism. I mean, this is where you see the rank corruption that has really just subverted all of these institutions, attaching themselves to anonymous sources, attaching themselves to just repeating things that, even as the journalist himself, Jeffrey Goldberg himself, starts admitting that parts of his story may not be true. I mean, this is where things just become a muscled narrative that they just continue, again, this battering ram idea that is just, you know, we've seen it so many times. I don't know how effective it becomes among the MAGA people, among people who see what Trump has done for the military. I mean, this is the thing. It's like a conversation in private alleged to have taken place several years ago versus his reorganization of the VA, his efforts to rebuild the military, his absolutely splendid record of not putting men in harm's way in new wars. I mean, this is really what's going on here, the endless war group versus the America First group. I mean, this is sort of the crux of this effort. He is announcing further drawdowns in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is, you know, what he ran on. I mean, this is the kind of basic philosophical and political divide that these people are trying to run away from through slander. I mean, this is a big, important issue that is actually divides them, but they try to make it a matter of character. But it doesn't stand up next to the man's works. I mean, along with all of the people who have come forward by name to actually knock the story down, you know, including General Kelly's chief of staff, to the press secretary at the time, to the ambassador to France. I mean, it's just a plethora of people who are in and around this alleged incident who have come out by name to knock it down versus these anonymous sources, which people are, I think, starting to really understand is the basis of fake news. You cannot run the country on anonymous sources, and you cannot direct the news that way. And this is what we start to understand. This is just a dishonest machine of propaganda.
Dana, I want to touch on the sensitive subject because, in part, in response to all of this, the president has sort of taken a point that you touched on there a moment ago and your phrase, the endless wars crowd, to suggest that this really is about, you know, the military-industrial complex and the desire to have these wars so that, you know, there will be lots of money for defense contractors who will produce the kit that gets expended in those wars. I must say, I don't see it that way. I do worry about finding ourselves shorthanded in Afghanistan. Not that I want to see us perpetuate the war as it has been fought to date, or the presence of large numbers of Americans in terms of big army boots on the ground. But I do fear that we may find ourselves, as we have in the past under notably Barack Obama and Joe Biden, making, not because of the military-industrial complex or other considerations, but making decisions that we will find embolden our enemies and return some of these places that we have been trying to manage, shall we say, reverting to form as very dangerous to our security interests and those of our allies in the region. And I know you've, you know, got some different views on this, and I'd welcome your thoughts.
Yes, well, I think that the military-industrial complex financial aspect is only the beginning of the argument against the endless wars crowd, which is sort of a silly way to express it, but I guess it conveys. There is also the globalist mission to essentially run the world as a one-world government, using the United States as a one-world policeman leader. I mean, there is also kind of a strategic component that goes into the people who want to fight all over the world rather than take care of America. These are often the people who are also against our borders and against returning manufacturing and against returning America to a nation state with its own set of foreign policy and domestic policy imperatives. So it's larger than just a financial motivation here, in my view. But I think that what's very important is to understand that not everywhere in the world is America's line in the saddle, in the sand. Not everywhere is our line of battle. And I think that this is something that we have not understood for so long, because in fighting over there, remember George Bush told us we would fight the Islamic terrorists over there, so we didn't fight them over here. Well, that was sort of a carryover from the whole kind of internationalist way to fight communism abroad and not fight it at home. In other words, Islam was very dangerous to us in Iraq or Afghanistan, but Islamic immigration meant nothing to us here. Sharia meant nothing to us here. We had to fight these things overseas. The same was true in the Cold War. we were fighting communism, which was considered very, very dangerous so long as it was thousands of miles away from us in countries we had never heard of until we fought there. However, people who were afraid of communist subversion at home were laughed at because communism meant nothing at home. So what I look at is an arc of attrition on our military forces, on our military might, on our strategic focus, always abroad, while America at home has been undermined, subverted, and almost destroyed. And that's when Donald Trump comes on the scene and says, enough with men from Iowa dying in Afghanistan and other far reaches. We need to start rebuilding at home, and it starts with a border. And this upset the entire globalist project, and I think it's all connected. And when you look at the generals and admirals who come out against him and speak in terms that are alarmingly like preparations for a military takeover, you look at them all and you understand these are actually leftists. I mean, I've done deep dives on them for 10 years. These are men with globalist objectives and missions in their mind. This is where they are in their own political development. I consider many of them to be political first and military second.
And perhaps were promoted for this reason by the Obama-Biden team. Dino, we are over time, but I did want to thank you for that explanation of your thinking on this subject, and it will be a subject to which I know we will return next week. Thank you for your time today. Keep up the good work, my dear, at dianawest.net, talking the days to come. Next up, we will speak with Bradley Thayer, who's got some important insights on some revision to the longtime globalist thinking about China that is worth taking note of as well. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Dr. Bradley Thayer, an extraordinarily thoughtful and deeply knowledgeable expert on China and the Chinese Communist Party. He is the author, among other books, of Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics, How China Sees the World. He is also a frequent contributor to The Hill newspaper, including a recent piece entitled The End of the Old Regime in the Sino-American Relationship. And I wanted to visit with him about all of that. Brad is also a professor of political science at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which I'm very grateful. Brad Thayer, it's good to have you back. Welcome. So let's talk about this important piece, because you really are, I think, with great precision, illuminating the dramatic change that Donald Trump has precipitated in terms of American policy towards communist China. From that pursued by, well, basically his predecessors going back to Lyndon Johnson, I'd say, of both Republican and Democratic stripes. How would you characterize the Trump policy approach?
The Trump policy approach can be defined first by the recognition that China is an enemy of the United States. And that's a very important development in American strategy and for our foreign and defense policies. Secondly, it's defined by a strategy to develop pushback, to develop ways to counter China in the economic realm. We've certainly have seen that almost from the outset of the Trump administration. In the technological realm, we can see the FBI's investigation of so many individuals who've been involved in supporting China's or advancing technological transfer to China illegally, or in some areas it's a gray area, but nonetheless it should not occur. And then politically, the emphasis of the Trump administration on working to continue to develop our relationship with India, very important counterbalance to China, as well as to sustain great relations with Japan, with Australia, and other states in the region, as well as globally. So that's a very important development.
Yeah, these are, it would seem, eminently sensible policies in light of what has happened, in particular under Xi Jinping, the current General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and his aspirations, which are now made more and more aggressively known to the rest of us, basically it's about dominating the world. It's about displacing, if not actually destroying, the United States. So it's hard to believe that anyone would feel otherwise than you have just described President Trump does. And yet there is still with us. And I would like to ask you about specifically Vice President Joe Biden's views on all of this. But the elite in America, it seems, the business elite, the financial markets elite, the academic elite, with notable exceptions like your good self, the media elite, you know, the political elite, to some extent at least, remains deeply wedded, it seems, to the previous policy, the so-called engagement policy. Is that your view, or is it now the case that really everybody's kind of woken up to the realities and is with the president in adjusting course?
Well, my argument is that we're in a new epoch, a new era of international politics. We've left the order that was defined between 1989 and 2016, the era of globalization, the era of allowing China to rise with no serious counterbalancing attempts made by the United States during that time. So in the new period, China has risen. It's a great power, and it's well on its way to being a superpower. And as you observe, Xi Jinping does have those aspirations for China. The grand strategy of China is to dominate the world. So in this new era, we cannot go back to the previous one. We cannot go back to cooperating with China and expecting China to not become more aggressive in international politics. In the new era, China has power, and it's exerting it against U.S. interests, and everyone in the world sees that. And that needs to be balanced. So we are in the era of competition. As you know, the Pentagon and others call it the era of great power competition, and rightfully enough. So those politicians who want to go back to that period where they would trade influence for essentially resources, for lucre, for other aspects, personal enrichment, we can't go back to that because the Chinese are not going to identify them as being particularly useful tools anymore in this era of competition. The American people, we've gone through a sea change. The Wuhan virus was instrumental in that, but also China's belligerence is instrumental in that. And while large segments of the elite don't want to recognize it, we can't go back we can't change the distribution of power as it's defined in international politics.
Let me ask you about that, because I want to believe you're right, and I certainly think you should be right, given the objective realities that we're confronting here. And yet, we have seen in Vice President Joe Biden, including in the course of this campaign, albeit somewhat erratically, continued enthusiasm for China's rise and the opportunities for America to facilitate that. It's a powerful new documentary movie. Mentioned it in the past, but I want to once again urge our audience to take a look at it. It's available for free. Peter Schweizer's new film, Riding the Dragon, The Biden's China Secrets. This film, Brad Thayer, very powerfully describes, indicts, maybe a better verb for it, the Biden family for decades of efforts on behalf of and collaboration with the Chinese Communist Party to their personal enrichment, I think it has to be said, and to the nation's detriment. When you, and I understand you've seen this film, when you take a look at that, are you convinced that were Joe Biden to become president of the United States, that we wouldn't see an effort to continue more or less business as usual as it had been practiced previously?
We would see the attempt to do that. We would certainly see that Wall Street and centers of finance want to return to the old order, They want to have that relationship with China where they share technology with it, knowledge, processes, et cetera, in return for wealth, right, in return for a pecuniary gain. What has happened is we need to recognize that we've lost strategy, the conception of strategy in the United States. We should have never allowed this to happen. We should have never allowed Wall Street financial markets to establish such a relationship to transfer technology or businesses. At the same time, we should have recognized the Chinese Communist Party was using our politicians and others for influence. They would gain influence by providing resources, by providing wealth, pecuniary and other ways of profiting from a positive relationship with China. So the as a result of change in the balance of power in international politics, as a result of the virus, as a result of, at the macro level, changing perceptions about China, and thankfully, at last, at the highest level of the U.S. government, we're identifying China as a threat. So there would certainly be, if Biden were to become president, there would certainly be the effort to return to normalcy from his perspective, right? To go back to the way things were. And everybody will get rich, and China will continue to grow without any effective balancing. And if that were to happen, that would be the second greatest grand strategic mistake made by the United States. The first was allowing China to rise, except balancing against it.
Let me ask you, Brad Thayer, sort of keying off of the subject of your latest book, Han Centrism, what you think the Chinese Communist Party is making of the, well, I guess the term for it is kowtowing, that Disney has been engaging in of late, notably with its remake of the film Mulan, in which it offers, quote, special thanks, unquote, to no fewer than 8 different CCP entities in what's known as East Turkestan, or by the Chinese, Xinjiang, where they are brutally oppressing millions of Uyghurs, many of them in concentration camps, among those being thanked is the Public Security Bureau, which is responsible for that. Some have described it as genocidal oppression.
China is a huge market for Hollywood, and money calls the shots at the end of the day. So Hollywood, Disney wants to sell that product in China, and will do so. But in order to do that, you have to acquiesce to the demands of the Communist Party of China. And that's going to require that human rights abuses, gross human rights abuses, and one of the most egregious developments in the 21st century is that we have concentration camps again in China, right, in Xinjiang, for Chinese Muslims, Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and others.
Brad Thayer, there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll return to us soon on all of these issues. Thank you for the work you're doing at the University of Texas San Antonio, Brad, and for your important book, Han Centrism. Come back to us again soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Todd Bensman, who is a remarkable ally in the fight for what I think of as the war for the free world. His specialty is what's happening in our own hemisphere and what that means in particular for our border security and immigration policy more generally. These days, he is a senior fellow at a terrific organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, but he brings a wealth of experience and insights from his time as a journalist, his time as an intelligence professional working for the Department of Public Safety in his native state of Texas. And he is one of our go-to guys on so many issues, and we're delighted to be able to go to him now. Todd, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Always happy to be here, Frank.
Good. Let me ask you about something that you published at the Center for Immigration Studies, which you can find, folks, at cis.org. It was entitled A Dystopian Biden Effect in the Offing on Illegal Immigration. I know you set this piece up by talking about the Trump effect on immigration, and maybe we could start with a little reminder as to what that was, and is it still, if I can use the expression, in effect?
Yeah, so 4 years is an eternity in the political cycles, but people still may remember that when Trump first took office, and especially during the period between the election and the inauguration, just his campaign messaging and speech from the prior year had what was called a Trump effect on illegal immigration at the border, meaning that it dried up completely. Immigrants south of the border on the way here assumed that if they got over the border, they would all be arrested and, you know, locked up and imprisoned and terrible things would happen. So illegal immigration almost stopped. It dropped by 70%. All of the U.S. immigration facilities emptied almost completely. And they called this the Trump effect. And it wore off after a while when it was realized that it was going to take a while for his policies to actually be implemented. There were lawsuits filed and lots of obstructionism.
Notably with respect to the wall, but also with respect to some of the enforcement arrangements on these illegal immigrants.
Yes, on asylum and deportation and lots of different policies that he had promised during the campaign. Eventually, those wore off and illegal immigration resumed, as we know, and actually reached crisis levels sometime later. But what I argue is that under that Biden, the campaign is messaging the opposite kinds of promises that will encourage and has encouraged illegal immigrants who are planning to come to the United States, and that an equal and opposite Biden effect is in the offing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the specific policies to which Biden has committed as part of his campaign, and I guess specifically his deal with the Bernie Sanders wing of the party.
Well, there are two really important messages that have been heard all through Latin America and the populations. And the first is that Biden has promised a 100-day moratorium on all deportations. That is music to the ears of immigrants, illegal immigrants, people who are planning to come to the United States, that they will be immune from deportation for months.
Because that is likely to translate into being allowed to stay, or simply because it doesn't mean at least an instant turnaround?
Right, yeah, all of the above. The goal of illegal immigrants is to get into the country and live illegally, for join the 12 to 20 million population of people working illegally in the country. So if you don't have to worry about deport, Trump was arguing, you know, we're going to deport all of you. And Biden is promising we will deport none of you, even criminals. So that is music to the ears. They all heard that. All of the smuggling networks, everybody is just sort of waiting in the wings for this, for the election on that. The other crucial Biden policy is that he would not be expected to maintain Trump's threat of trade tariffs against the Mexican government for not controlling its southern border with Guatemala. Remember that Trump threatened, this is a purely, Trumpian kind of policy, big stick policy that presidents rarely use, where he told the Mexicans, if you don't get your border under control with troops, we're going to slap 25% progressive trade tariffs on everything coming over the border. And so the Mexican president ordered 6,000 troops to his southern border, and it was very effective. I know because I went there and I toured the Mexican military deployment, spent time with the troops on the ground and with the migrants in January of this year. And it was incredibly effective at slowing immigration through. A Biden presidency would not maintain that threat. And so the troops would go back to the barracks, and the country of Mexico would revert to its traditional role as a wide open superhighway for illegal immigration. There are other things too. Biden has promised, free medical care, welfare benefits to all, including food and shelter once they come over the border. And all of this taken together is heard loud and clear in Honduras, in Guatemala, and all around the world.
Yeah, let me just drill down on that last point, because that seems to me to be very important as well. We've talked about this in the past, Todd, the tractor beam, to use a Star Trek term, of incentives to come to this country. If you can get free stuff, whether it's free healthcare or free education or welfare benefits or what have you, without regard to your status as an illegal alien, would seem to be nothing but upside if you can get in. And there's reason to believe that Joe Biden would make it possible for you to get in. So here's the question, I guess, Todd, and we do appreciate that there are differences between the two candidates, and those differences need to be very clearly understood by the voters. And in the briefest of brief forms, how would you characterize the choice between the man who has brought us the Trump effect, albeit with some mixed results due to resistance to the wall and lawsuits and the rest, on the one hand, and the man you would anticipate would bring us the Biden effect?
Yeah, polar opposite effects. Absolutely, you could not possibly conjure up two policies that are as opposed to one another as these two. Remember, Biden, when he was with Obama, who was once called the deporter in chief, was serving as a vice president during during regular times before the left wing, the left part of the Democratic coalition was empowered like it is now. And so you're not just electing Joe Biden, you're electing a coalition that includes a powerful left side. That left side absolutely demands open borders, expects open borders, and by that I mean just full-fledged, nobody will be stopped, everybody will be helped, everybody will be encouraged. All Trump policies, Trump-era policies, will be reversed systematically on day one. I put on day one in quotes because that's what Biden said he would do as a sop to his left wing. So it really is just a very stark contrast. I expect a migrant crisis to begin on November 4th, and it will escalate between November 4th to, I hope I'm wrong, by the way, to Inauguration Day and beyond.
Well, this would depend in part on the outcome of the election, of course. Presumably, if Donald Trump wins a landslide victory, that doesn't happen. If it's a landslide for Biden, it will. If it's unclear who won and what comes next, it may well be one of the features that we have to contend with, among a great many others that will be pretty horrible, I anticipate. Todd Bensman, thank you for all that you do. Stay well, my friend. I hope the rest of you will make a point of coming back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.